De la revolución del mundo. Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So as noted, this is the UAW Labor for Palestine panel. If you are not looking for that, you are in the wrong session. I'm sorry. The panel examines working class support for Palestine from the League of Revolutionary Black Workers stance in 1969, Arab-led auto worker strikes in 1973, Labor for Palestine since 2004, Block the Boat ILWU since 2014, to mushrooming rank-and-file solidarity with Palestinian trade unions since 2023, including UAW 2325's ongoing resistance to a congressional witch hunt and demands to end UAW complicity with Zionism. So in order of the way people are sitting and also the way they're going to speak at first, I have Michael Letwin, who is a public defender, former president of the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys, UAW 2235, a co-founder of Labor for Palestine, yes, and a member of UAW Labor for Palestine and NYC Labor for Palestine. Marcy Pedraza is an electrician at Ford Chicago Assembly Plant in Chicago, a member of UAW Local 551 and UAW Labor for Palestine, and labor and climate advisor for the Southeast Environmental Task Force. Sharina Razek is president of the Graduate Labor Organization at Brown, co-founder of the Palestine Solidarity Caucus of AFT-RIFT Local 6516, and works with the Labor for Palestine National Network. And finally, last but not least, Shahinez Gened is a member of GENU-UAW, HAW-UAW, and UAW Labor for Palestine, an organizing fellow with the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and an international human rights lawyer and social scientist drawing on her lived experience as an Egyptian American. So Michael, handing it over to you.
Right afterwards. So thank you all for being here, and greetings, and free Palestine. Yes, I am a proud, I need to stress that I am a proud member of UAW 2325, and you know, to say also that for all of us in this room and for millions around the world, not to mention in Palestine itself, it is sometimes hard not to feel moments of despair over the unspeakable images of U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza and throughout Palestine by Israel, which I think deserves the title the Zionist entity. It well deserves that, that temporarily occupies the nation of Palestine. But I'm also proud to say that in this country, that resistance has now included UAW Labor for Palestine, along with so many other millions of people that are standing for Palestine, including in labor. And UAW Labor for Palestine was formed in the wake of, shortly after October 7, 2023, as a collective of rank-and-file members of the UAW demanding an immediate end not only to the genocide, current genocide in Gaza, or the currently escalated genocide in Gaza, but to the entire Israeli apartheid machine, occupation, and the ongoing Nakba, or ethnic cleansing, of Palestine that continues to this day, since 1948 and even before. And embraces especially the recent and urgent calls from Palestinian trade unions to, as they put it, end all complicity and stop arming Israel. So we in UAW Labor for Palestine organize at the individual, the shop, the local, and regional levels to organize UAW members to end, in our particular case, the international UAW's longstanding complicity in labor Zionism, which will be discussed some, I think, today in detail, but also to mobilize our members to go beyond that to take direct action in support of Palestine by honoring the call from Palestinian trade unions to actually end the genocide. And so UAW Labor for Palestine, in turn, is one of more than now 40 member groups of the Labor for Palestine National Network, which is located at laborforpalestine.net. And the Labor for Palestine itself was launched in April of 2004 to reclaim, as Sarah mentioned, the legacy of working class solidarity with Palestine in the United States, which really has its roots in the groundbreaking statements by the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit in 1969, and also, and maybe especially, the wildcat strikes and protests that were led by Arab and Black UAW members, not against their own companies, but rather against their own union, which was supporting Israeli genocide in 1973, during the 1973 war, and which really was an amazing outpouring of rank and file action to hold our own union leadership accountable. And so Labor for Palestine as a whole endorses the 2005 Palestinian-led BDS picket line, but also really focuses on the fact that workers have unparalleled power, just as we have unparalleled power in so many other ways, to go beyond words and actually stop the genocide in Gaza. And this is what we urge people to do as the network, to demand an immediate end to the siege and to all U.S. military aid for Israel, to follow the example of Block the Boat, which many of you will know about in the Bay Area, which has stopped Zimline ships, Israeli ships, from landing on the West Coast for the last 10 years with the solidarity of ILWU Local 10 members, and to refuse to build or transport weapons just for Israel. To also respect the BDS picket line by severing ties with Israel's racist labor federation, the Histadrut, and its U.S. mouthpiece, the Jewish Labor Committee, and by divesting from Israel bonds, which so many of our unions own, including the UAW, and all industries connected with Zionist settler colonialism and occupation. And I just want to also emphasize that although there's a lot of what might seem to be rhetoric in there, and there is, we in labor, in this space, try very hard to focus on the fact that the BDS movement is a picket line. To put it in labor terms, it's a picket line. It's an injury to one is an injury to all. These are the most fundamental labor precepts of solidarity. And we walk picket lines as union members. We don't cross picket lines. And that's the message that we have for why this is a labor issue. One, an injury to one is an injury to all. Two, our tax dollars fund Israel. Three, our workplaces arm Israel. Four, our unions fund Israel. And five, rank and file workers can stop Israeli genocide. So to finally just say in this part that at last week's protests here in Chicago at the DNC, UAW, Labor for Palestine, and other Labor for Palestine members, as well as members of Chicago Labor for Palestine here, and other organizations, charged the Democrats with genocide, because they're the ones that are running this genocide, and called on our unions not to endorse, that is on behalf of Labor for Palestine, we called on our members not, or our unions not to endorse the Harris Waltz or any other candidates complicit in the genocide. And in that, we hope, in that resistance, both in Palestine and here at home, there is hope. Thank you.
Michael's pretty tall. Hi, everyone. Marcy Pedraza. Well, Michael just took my whole speech. No, I'm kidding. First off, I want to thank the Socialism Conference for having me come here and speak to you all today. Some familiar faces, so sorry if some of this is repetitive. I think this is probably the fifth or sixth time I've told this story about what happened in my local 551, but you know, it's, bless you, or it's sad that I still have to that we're still, you know, making these demands and trying to call out our unions to do the right thing, right, in our country, in our government. So I've been an electrician 25 years, started on the outside, IBEW, then went into manufacturing. and always have, leaned to the left in my politics. So it's constantly a challenge, you know, getting labor and the workers, labor movement on board with climate justice, with, you know, ending a genocide even, because most of us just want to, like, go to work and come home, take care of ourselves, our families. But when you think about what's going on in this world, you know, I just couldn't sit back and do nothing. And that's how I try to talk about it with workers. You know, how does this relate to them? You know, I have people asking me, well, like, what is really going on? And why should we care about this issue? You know, it's so far away. And I just, you know, I have to be blunt and say, you know, people are dying. Like, our tax dollars are funding this genocide. And thousands of people, I mean, this was months ago, are being obliterated. And it's been going on for decades. It didn't just start, you know, on October 7th. And one of my first actions around Palestine was going on a bus trip to D.C. with a bunch of mostly Arab women from Chicago with the Arab American Action Network. And that was just so moving for me to be a part of that. And that was, I think, maybe 15 years ago. So when you know, it was great that back in, I think it was December, when the International Union and UAW and other unions were standing up and demanding a ceasefire, I said, well, maybe we could take it a step further and not just say ceasefire now. How about standing in solidarity with Palestinian workers and other trade unionists around the world that are demanding, you know, right, an end to aid to Israel, stop funding, stop sending military aid. And like Michael said, we stand in solidarity with workers. We join picket lines. We don't cross them. So I wanted to propose this at Local 551 in Chicago, which, you know, we were part of the stand-up strike last fall, and everybody was still fired up from our strike and victories. But it's hard to get people together in a union meeting during December because of Christmas, and everybody's just tired. And so finally in January, we had a quorum, and I brought this proposal together, which I must admit I didn't write all myself, because I got a lot of it from, well, it's straight from the Palestinian trade unionist demand, you know, the five demands that Michael mentioned, but also I copied and pasted from our other UAW siblings, you know, and grad students, legal aid, and I said, hey, can I use this? Or they're like, yeah, go ahead. I didn't use all the pages they used because I felt like if I'm going to have a time at the mic in my union meeting, nobody's going to listen after a couple minutes. So I went through this really quickly, and there was a couple comments that I could tell they were trying to push back. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But it overwhelmingly passed, and, you know, just saying all these demands was surprising. But the way, thank you. The way this happened was I was talking about doing it right before the meeting because I had other, you know, committee meetings beforehand. I was with Skilled Trades and then the Women's and the Organizing Committee. I'm like, hey, I'm going to bring up this proposal. And my union brother, Scott Holdison, I knew he was good for a second. I'm like, you're going to second, right? He said, yeah. And then I just tried to encourage everybody else to, like, support. And thankfully, they did. But even though, you know, this is just one resolution, and it's just, it's about a lot more than that. And we could get into, you know, some of the pushback later, like I said. But basically, you know, our workers, we shouldn't be, we deserve good union jobs, right? We deserve a living wage. But it shouldn't be, we shouldn't have to sacrifice our moral compass for that. And thank you. And I was so inspired by the previous panel where my union sister, Jessie Kelly, was speaking at, and just, you know, talking about how are we going to get to this just transition to a peace economy where we make things that are better for our communities and our planet instead of destroying human lives. And, you know, my daughter's school's falling apart. You know, I'm in the campaign for a new green schools campaign here in Chicago, like, and we live in a sacrifice zone, so that would be something that we can work towards, you know, building new schools and green schools and things like that. So thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sharina. I am a Palestinian diasporic educator, labor organizer, activist, and I'm really happy to be joining you here, even though I'm not a UAW member. But I have lots to say about this panel, and I'm very happy to join you. When I arrived in Ramallah last summer in June, this before October 7th, which we have to remember, Israel was air raiding Jenin, resilient Jenin. Jenin, which is under attack again, and this unbelievable military aggression into the West Bank. The violence and the genocide that are happening right now in Gaza absolutely demand our attention, but I want us to think about all of occupied Palestine, from the river to the sea, and our duty as workers to be in solidarity with Palestinians in Jenin right now, in Gaza, all over. So Jenin is under attack again. East Jenin's being evacuated right now. And it made me recall last summer when Israel was air raiding Jenin that on my first day back in Palestine, a general strike was called, which is something that happens very often in Palestine. This is a society that can be mobilized and unified in an instant, and it's part of why the Palestinian society is so resilient and why we continue to survive and why we remain, because of this ability to mobilize. This is what an organized, resilient, resistant, revolutionary society demands. And so I think we have lots to learn from how Palestinians organize. So I'm gonna do a little history because I'm an academic, I apologize. Which, you know, reminded me when I was there experiencing this general strike, the 1936 Palestinian general strike, which started on April 19th, 1936, and went all the way through October of the same year, which launched the Great Arab Revolt, which erupted in this resistance movement. And this, you know, reminded me again then of the First Intifada, the boycotts of the First Intifada, the type of organization that was required to sustain a community that was trying to sever the economic stranglehold that Israel had over colonized Palestine. So although it's not very often, although we're doing this here today, although it's not very often portrayed in this way, land and labor are the co-constitutive sites of struggle between the settler, colonial, racial, capitalist, ethno-national Israeli Zionist movement in Palestine and the indigenous Palestinian national struggle for liberation. The struggle is often framed as a land struggle, because it is, because settler colonialism is about land theft and acquisition and takes the form of the elimination of the native, as Patrick Wolfe tells us, who also taught us that settler colonialism is a structure, not an event. And this is correct, historically, materially, politically, but I also think that this is not really the whole picture. This understanding of settler colonialism can obscure the role that labor has played in the formation of all settler colonies, which were reliant on enslaved plantation labor, as in the foundational and ongoing violence of this settler colony, or the exclusion and segregation of native labor in order to create autonomous settler economies on stolen or coercively purchased land, as is the case in Palestine. The State of Israel was declared in 1948, but the Zionist colonial project, it's much older than that, and this movement had put decades of work into cultivating the conditions for the total colonization of Palestine to make the Zionist entity a viable state to be built via the destruction of Palestine. The Jewish National Fund and what would become the Histadrut had to work together and closely with the financial and political backing of their imperial European partners to ensure that an ethno-nationalist colony could be built in conditions that were largely hostile to the formations of a capitalist, Jewish exclusive, or any really ethno-nationalist exclusive state in Palestine. Although Ottoman land reform had sort of paved the way for, at least for this first colonies to sort of, and plantations to take hold. So the first struggles between European Jewish colonists and native Palestinian Arabs were labor struggles, right? And I'm saying this in order to make connections to the problems with organized labor here and the work of rank and file to overcome them. And I think we have incredible scholars like Robin D.G. Kelly, who talks about this long history and the failures, actually, of segregated labor in our work and obligation and duty to overcome what empire, what these settler colonies try to do to defang our movements. And, you know, they do this because of the immense power in organized labor, in a unified political struggle towards liberation, that we as workers in the belly of the beast have a role to play in both here, at home, and across the world. I cannot begin to fathom how we're allowing billions of our dollars of working people's money to go to fund the extermination of a colonized people in an open-air prison, right? So I think everyone's here because we understand the gravity of the situation and our role to play as organized labor, and also the role of established leadership in undermining our efforts. And our, you know, that's also an age-old tradition that we're up against, and I'm just grateful to be in this struggle with you all.
Everyone is also taller than me. Hello. Okay. Hello, everyone. As Sarah introduced me, my name is Shahinez, and I am a unit member of GenU UAW, which is the Graduate Student Workers Union at Northeastern University, a member of HOW UAW, which is the Harvard Adjunct Faculty Union, both in Boston, and also a member and organizer with UAW Labor for Palestine and the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. I see many friendly faces here who I've met at previous actions, so I just am so happy to see you all again. I'm so happy to see new faces, and just thank you all for your commitment to the shared struggle. And thank you to the Socialism Conference for having us and for having me. So I think that in their introductions, Michael and Marcy covered a lot of, you know, the history of this movement for Labor for Palestine, for UAW Labor for Palestine, a lot of things. They did a great job. So I'm going to probably be a little bit shorter than them, but also just give you some context into what some of the locals I've been working with have been doing, and also just, like, my take on what's going on. So I'm going to say, first of all, that UAW Labor for Palestine, as Michael mentioned, has started organizing since October 7th and has been organizing for almost a year now, and that a year is truly far too long. 76 years is far too long. And that I think that we can all feel the growing frustration, anger, grief that this moment has brought for us, and also know that we need to keep working in this moment and keep pushing. Let me gather my thoughts. Yes, to know that we need to keep pushing in this moment, even when it feels impossible, because I have been someone who grew up in this country and in lived in many other Western countries as an Arab American, as an Egyptian American, and never thought that we would reach the point that we are now. Remember always feeling ostracized on the issue of Palestine, always silenced on the issue of Palestine. I was an organizer and the vice president of my university's Student for Justice in Palestine chapter as an undergraduate. That was when I first started really heavily organizing for Palestine. And I think in that moment, which was honestly not that long ago, it did not feel like we could move beyond, you know, educational events, community events with the people who already, you know, largely agreed with us, and into a space of really getting people out there and organizing. And this year has presented us a lot of victories and also just a lot of ground that we now know that we need to cover so that this cannot continue on for another year or another 76 years. I do very much believe that thanks to the actions of the labor movement and workers in particular in responding to the Palestinian trade union call, to the demands of the BDS movement, and to not cross the BDS picket line, as well as issuing calls to our unions, which do so much to fund Democratic politicians, to support Democratic politicians with phone banking and calling and canvassing and all of these things that they rely deeply on in our communities, that our calls for a permanent ceasefire and arms embargo have been very impactful. And we can see now that the economy of Israel, of the Zionist entity, is in a tailspin, thanks to the workers who have come out and said that this is not allowed. This is not going to continue to happen. And so labor for me, honestly, is giving me my first hope that we can and will achieve a free Palestine within our lifetimes. And I think that labor has an essential role to play as part of a global revolution and the freedom of Palestine. So I've been a member of UAW for 5 years, started working with UAW Labor for Palestine the past year. And like I said, in the past year, like, we've had just massive changes in the way that people in our locals are talking about Palestine, the way that people are engaging with the issue of Palestine. We've had resolutions across many locals, including my own. We've had protests and actions against the union's endorsement of pro-genocide candidates, who, again, we fund and we support with canvassing with our bodies year after year after year, because we're told that we have no better option and that we have to vote for them. And I think that this is just going to be like another one of those great events where we're going to be able to get together as labor unionists and really strategize about, like, what do the next several months look like, especially as we come across the full 1 year anniversary of October 7th. So thank you very much, and I'm so excited to talk more with you all.
Front then. Yeah, so I have a few questions for the panel that I'm going to throw to everybody here, and then we will take questions, comments from the audience. Also, we are recording just so people know that that's happening when you are speaking from the audience. But first, I don't know who wants to take this one first, but what are the origins of labor for Palestine, and why focus on rank and file solidarity with Palestine? Anybody? Michael?
Michael would be great for that.
So I tried to say a little bit about the origins of Labor for Palestine and some of the historical shoulders that we stand on, you know, in doing that work now, going back more than half a century. But I think, you know, I guess what I want to try to focus in on is, you know, there are some unions that haven't even come out for ceasefire. I mean, international unions, right? And that, you know, their kind of role in this is self-evident. It's less clear when it comes to the unions like ours, the UAW, and the other six or so international unions that have come out for not only ceasefire, but now recently for an arms embargo, which is obviously symbolically, you know, a major step and is welcome. But the problem is, and the reason really why we have Labor for Palestine, and we can't just, you know, rely on the union leaderships to deal with this, is that there's a huge gap between what UAW, for example, leadership says and what it has done or not done. Because remember, the call, you know, from Palestinian trade unions is an urgent call. I mean, the May Day call came out and said, resolutions and conferences are not enough. You know, we don't need that from you. What we need from you is to stop the genocide. You have the power, stop the genocide. Stop arming Israel. And that's, I think, where the gap is, you know, really clear. So there are certain myths, for example, that come up about UAW history that you'll hear, that, you know, Walter Reuther and other UAW leaders championed civil rights, and that they were part of the Vietnam anti-war movement and the movement against apartheid South Africa, and that they were against the Iraq war. But the reality historically is that the UAW and other unions didn't actually lift a finger to stop the Vietnam War or the Iraq war, let alone Afghanistan. They betrayed the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, you know, in 1964, and sought to silence the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and practice systemic racism towards black auto workers in Detroit that led to groups like the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and DRUM. And, it, you know, as mentioned above or earlier, the UAW leadership in particular has been complicit with Zionism for, you know, as long as the UAW has existed, and certainly since 1948. And what that's looked like is, you know, a strong commitment to labor Zionism, buying into every aspect of it and supporting Israel, you know, down the line. And there's a similar myth about today that you know, the UAW does have a reform leadership, which many of us here supported. In fact, all of us in the UAW are part of UAWD, I think it's fair to say, here on this panel, which is what made Sean Fain president of the UAW, and that's a good thing. But it also needs to be said that Sean Fain and the other, you know, what I call the ceasefire unions, is not living up to the fact, you know, to its myth, to its reputation for having been the first, in our case, the UAW leadership, the first to call for a ceasefire of the major unions. And so in reality, you know, the UAW leaders had remained silent for months. It took us months to get them to issue a lot of rank and file pressure from people in this room and beyond, hundreds of rank and file UAW members to force the UAW to say they were for a ceasefire. But even then, that was not brought to the membership by the leadership. Most people in the UAW don't even know that the UAW has passed a ceasefire statement or that they're calling for an arms embargo. It hasn't spoken out to defend my local, the 2325, the public defenders in New York City, who were one of the first unions to call for supporting the Palestinian trade union call and now are under congressional investigation for having done so. It hasn't stood up with the 4811 graduate students in California who went on strike a couple months ago around Palestine. And it's failed to mobilize members in the UAW who actually produce weapons for Israel. And it's not, you know, and who do research for Israel, not because they want to, these members, because this is their jobs and they don't have any say over that. But the UAW leadership does and should have a say over that and should be organizing members to deal with that. And so the point about, and I would just add that, you know, the sort of the icing on this cake is the fact that Sean Fain endorsed, you know, first Biden and then Harris-Waltz, the people that are providing all the weapons for the genocide, spoke it last week at the DNC, lauding the Democrats, didn't mention Gaza or Palestine once. Not once, let alone use the leverage of saying, we're not going to endorse you until you stop arming Israel. So what do you make of that? What do you do with that? And I think the answer for us is that that's why we have UAW Labor for Palestine. That's why rank and file work is so important throughout our unions and why, in fact, the momentum of Labor for Palestine work has come from rank and file. And the difference between talking the talk and walking the walk is all that really matters. Nothing else matters.
Thank you, Michael. I'll be a little briefer than that, brief, because I don't have that much to add. But yeah, as he was saying, you know, this week I was at the UAW Women's Conference here across the street at the Marriott, whatever. But it was for the International UAW. And, you know, it was a big group of women, and of course Sean Fain was there, and I had a little chance to go talk to him. I'm going to say it, you know, because the whole week was a Kamala Fest, right? It's like, yay, rent the signs, and it was just me and a few other comrades with these buttons. We're all looking at each other like, okay. So we were doing some group picture and rally at a park nearby, and I just went up to him. I was like, hey, so, you know, you're endorsing the Democrats, you know, are you going to hold them accountable and keep demanding that we stop sending aid to Israel? He's like, oh, yeah, we're going to keep trying. We're going to keep pushing. And I was going to keep going. And his bodyguard's looking at me. I'm like, all right, I'm going to get out of here. I mean, you know, he already knows me because at Labor Notes, my daughter and I gave him this pin, this Labor for Palestine pin. And he took it and he wore it for a day. And it was great. You know, and then I tried to give one to Sean O'Brien, the Teamsters president. I was with Mrs. Potter, Jackson Potter's mom. He's the vice president of Chicago Teachers Union. And we still love telling that story, how we ambushed him and asked him, why are you meeting with Trump? And then we tried to give him this button. And he was like, oh, no, we're busy fighting corporate America. I'm like, well, so are we. You know, the unions, the UAW, the Teamsters, that are you know, we are one of the main unions whose members manufacture weapons for against Palestinian people, and not just the Palestine, but, you know, around the world, you know, as an imperialist country. So anyway, but that's just what I was going to say about that. And also trying to demand that our unions divest funds to Israel, which we tried that a couple months ago with our international had a vote to divest funds, and it wasn't a significant amount. I think it was maybe $500,000 or so. And, you know, we reached out to our regional directors. It unfortunately did not pass. And I asked our region 4 director, you know, why. I sent him a letter, and then I sent him a message, and he wrote back, which was great. But he just said he felt like it didn't really make it, it was going to cost too much to divest in the end, like it would cost them more. I'm like, so you're putting a price on human lives, is what you're saying. And then he gave us a politician answer, like, well, what about this? And what about workers here and there? I'm like, well, yes, we should be fighting for all of that too, but this is what I'm talking about right now. And he just tried to go around the subject. And I saw him too this week, and he kept avoiding me like the plague. Because he was like, I want to have a conversation with you in person. I said, okay, I'll see you at the women's conference. Anyway, so yeah, that's what I was going to say about that. Thank you.
Yeah, just a few things to add to this question and why we focus on rank and file. Organizing, that's where the power actually resides, right? Despite these illusions or despite these cults of personality in some cases in my union, that is where the power actually resides. That is where change will actually happen. And I think, you know, in my grad local, like we really try to have like a truly dedicated organizing model of union where, you know, these like the statements we make are important, our political convictions are important, but if we're not talking one-on-one with our coworkers and our other union members, we don't get to the kind of organization that, you know, Palestinians have where they can call a general strike when something happens. And like that's the kind of power that we need to build, and that's going to require us doing the organizing separate from the establishment unions that of which we are a part, right? I'm so proud to be a member of my local. I'm not proud of the AFT. So that's why we focus on rank and file. And the other thing I wanted to say about Labor for Palestine, Michael brought me on about a year ago now, and I think this network existing has been so beneficial. Just first of all, for morale, to see all of the workers across the country and the continent who are organizing and mobilizing in their workplaces, doing this kind of one-on-one stuff, the political education, the direct action, the work actions, knowing that we're not alone in this, because work can be very alienating and isolating. It's kind of the point, right, of capitalism. So having this network, I think, has also been so crucial to, you know, moving us to the point where we're now making interventions at national conventions, which, you know, fellow members of AFT for Palestine, we did, and, you know, it was our first go. We didn't win, but we made a step forward, and that's what matters.
Yeah.
I think I will be brief, as everyone has covered a lot of it already, but I think one more thing on why we focus on rank and file solidarity in particular is that I think if, I don't know how many of you are in Labor for Palestine, but all of you have been doing Palestine stuff, I'm assuming, if you're here. So I'm getting lots of nods. So I'm going to say, yes, great, thank you. When you're working on the inside, you can see that between, you know, when we actually first started calling for a ceasefire statement, for instance, and when we got a ceasefire statement is a period of months. When we called for a vote for the International Executive Board of the UAW to divest from Israeli bonds, and when we actually even got the vote, that was a period of months. And now, you know, try and get them to redo the vote, since it didn't go through, as Marcy mentioned, it's going to be a period of more months. Like, the actual leadership of these organizations is always behind what the rank and file is asking for. We're the ones that have to push. At the end of the day, I don't care. They can take all the credit for it, but we're the ones that push behind the scenes to make it impossible for them to ignore these demands.
Yeah. Amazing. All right, so I'm just going to ask one more question of all of you, but this one might involve a few longer stories, because this is the question about how you've been organizing in your local unions and what pushback have you all received. Anybody want to go first on this one? I keep making Michael go first, so somebody else this time. Marcy, all right.
Okay, now for the fun stories. No, not that fun. Yeah, so like I said, first at the local union meeting, you know, there was a couple comments about, what about Israel? Even when I started to do my pre-organizing about, hey, I'm going to propose this resolution, one of the group chats, somebody said, isn't that anti-Semitism? I said, no, it's anti-Zionism. And I said, you can look that up, because I don't have time to teach you today. And so... You know, and then But like I said, it was overwhelmingly passed two nays out of about 100 people. And then people say, well, that's not a lot. You know, that doesn't really represent the membership. I'm like, well, we are the ones that always go to the meetings. We are the ones elected or appointed or whatever. So I think that represents the membership. That was some pushback I got from our regional leadership. And then, you know, posting on Facebook, I immediately asked or demanded from our recording secretary to put it on our UAW letterhead, our local letterhead, so that I can share it all over the Twitterverse and whatever. And soon after that, you know, all the calls coming in, they asked me to take it down. I'm like, what do you mean take it down? From the internet? Like, I don't know if you know how it works, but it's there. It's there forever. So I took it down our little private group pages because there were some, you know, mean, hateful comments that I didn't even want to answer and just disgusted me. So I'm like, all right, I'll take it down from these pages that nobody else is seeing but our rank and file membership. But that didn't mean I didn't keep pushing and posting things about actions going on, you know, in the city or even in the area. We did a rally at AM General in South Bend, Indiana, where it's UAW shop that makes Humvees for Israel. And it was about, you know, the big marches in Chicago have been great and big crowds, but you know, these little ones are important too. Like there was about 100 people, not just from the Chicagoland, Northwest Indiana area. You know, environmentalists came out, workers came out, Arabs from mosques nearby and in the region came out, and it was a good turnout to protest this company, not the workers, to protest the company. And then when the like I said, our local executive board, I guess, tried to, you know, say, well, we shouldn't put that out there, you know, whatever. I'm like, well, it passed, so it's out there. And then when I was, like I said, when I was talking to our regional director about the resolution and the divestment of funds, he said, well, didn't your resolution get rescinded? I'm like, by whom? He's like, oh, I don't know, the Illinois Zionists. I'm like, what is that? It made me think of Illinois Nazis from the Blues Brothers. I'm like, what is that? Is that even a thing? And how can somebody else outside of our local rescind our resolution? So I had one of my comrades who's more legal expertise than me look it up, Zach. And he's like, oh, yeah, the NLRB rejected their request, but I think it's going back and forth in appeal. Anyway, like I said, it doesn't matter. The resolution passed in my eyes, and whether they want to take it back or not, it's out there, and it's just one shop, and it still needs to go further than that. You know, actions speak louder than words on paper, right? So, yeah, and just what gives me hope is even with all the pushback, every once in a while I get a comment or a message, a private message, like, hey, I saw you out there at the march in the DNC. Let me know. And this is from a 551 member who I had no idea was interested in this at all. But, you know, I met her on the picket lines last fall. And she's like, let me know when the next action is. I want to come out. I want to participate. So more workers are, you know, listening and wanting to do something and get involved. And they even asked me, I don't know how you do it. Like one day we went to organize this shop in the suburbs, which is mostly undocumented Spanish-speaking workers that make parts for our cars. Small shop, 400 or 500 people. We did a rally that day. And I was trying to tell our 551, you know, coworkers, like, hey, I'm going to this rally today after the DNC. You want to come out? Like, no, man, I'm tired. You know, like, well, I'm tired too. But you know. Anyway, so that's what I was going to say about pushback.
I can jump in. Yeah, so I've been organizing. I'm a grad worker at Brown. I've been an elected leader for 4 years. I actually just finished my tenure as president, so now I get to be a crazy rank and file member, which I'm very excited about, and accountable to no one. Just kidding, accountable to all. But yeah, so our Palestine organizing really started when we were forming our union. I was a first year at the time, and our Students for Justice in Palestine had actually pressured and lobbied and organized our university's ethical advisory committee to vote in favor of divestment back in 2019, which the president of the university has unceremoniously crushed since then. We're back in it since the encampment. But the story of our union's involvement in that is there were conversations amongst union organizers. This is like a really difficult campaign. Organizing grad workers is like herding cats. A lot of, you know, fickle autonomous beings. I love cats, though, so I guess I was built for the job. But there was like a lot of conversation at the time between our organizers about what to do, because this resolution or this undergraduate vote on divestment had just passed, and some folks were like, we need to win our union before we take a, you know, politically contentious stance on this issue. And we talked through it because that is a real concern to have, right? We had been trying to organize, I wasn't there yet. In the broader history, grads at Brown have been trying to organize a union for years, and we were finally getting very close. And eventually, people came together and decided, like, no, like, we need to have, like, what are our real commitments here on this? Who do we stand for? Who do we stand with? And the union decided, before we even had formal recognition, to endorse the undergraduate divestment vote. And from there, because we didn't sever bread and butter union stuff from political stances or from our political commitments, we've been able to really build and foster a truly anti-racist feminist union from day one. And so these conversations are important, and I think having, you know, the patience to talk to members, which isn't always easy, was crucial in that moment to then, you know, continue to move us towards this trajectory. And then step by step, we got to the point where we are today, where, you know, I was able to co-found the Palestine Solidarity Caucus in 2021 during the Unity Intifada, during one of the mowing the lawn incidents of genocidal air bombardment on the Gaza Strip, which is not new, of course. The Unity Intifada, which united the Palestinian political body across all of our diasporas and dispersals, mobilized, right? And so grad workers got together and we wrote a statement condemning the university's, you know, insistence on maintaining these ties with Israeli organizations, with their insistence on maintaining their investments and corporations facilitating the occupation and apartheid. And it got thousands of signatures, because in the years between that SJP endorsement and the Unity Intifada, we continued talking to our members about Palestine and making it a labor issue. Because really, our employer made it a labor issue by using the profits generated from our labor and investing them in a genocidal apartheid regime. There's been pushback also, right? And personally, I've taken a lot of the brunt of it through doxing, censorship. There's this horrible Zionist libelous report on the anti-Semitism problem at Brown, where I was condemned for teaching Angela Davis on my syllabus. Guilty as charged. But yeah, I think, you know, we took it step by step, and we really committed to the organizing model. We did walkthroughs. I was talking to neuroscientists and all kinds of scientists who were doing, I was very scared walking into their labs to talk to them, because there's like signs of like, don't touch this or whatever. But I'm like, you're my coworker. We're in these like isolated little units, but we work together. We have the same employer. We're facing a lot of the same struggles in our working conditions. And we have the right together to refuse the imperial conditions imposed on our labor. And so, you know, that has been pretty successful in our labor organizing at Brown, to the point now that new unions have joined our local on Palestine issues, on Palestine censorship. The Brown Center for Students of Color undergraduate workers unionized last year because they faced censorship on some programming they wanted to do on Palestine. And they came to us and they said, what can we do to organize against this? We don't agree with this. Our, you know, employer has been, you know, making all these kinds of changes and, you know, new exploitative conditions of their labor. And they organized a union and they won overwhelmingly. And like the labor movement at Brown, we're almost wall to wall at this point. And let me tell you, the AFT did not anticipate that in 2019, but we're proving them wrong through Palestine organizing. Yeah. That thing that people were worried about in the beginning of hurting or harming our progress as a union.
I think while we're on the topic of grad student organizing, it's a good time for me to jump in as well, having had similar experiences. So As I mentioned, I have been with the Graduate Student Worker Union at Northeastern for 4 going on 5 years now, so the entire duration that I've been in my PhD program so far. And it has been really hard to unionize Northeastern. If you know people know the history, it took us 8 years to get an election. It was just like egregious union busting from our employer. Like we would do a card drive and then they would start to like implement like changes. They'd give like some random department some more money. They'd like call people into like a meeting and try and like talk them out and say like, oh, you don't need a union. Like we'll give you the stuff that you want if you just like, you know, if you just work with us like one-on-one, we want to have this like intimate relationship with you, whatever. And then they're so horrible. And then, you know, the whole thing would fall apart. And then we'd do a card drive again. And then we'd do it again. And then we'd do it again. To the point that people were like, but I already signed a card. And it's like, no. You got to do this again if we're going to get an election. And it got to the point where we finally, in 2022, if I'm getting my years right, 2022 managed to get enough authorization cards. And we're like, okay, we're going to have an election. And the university did not want us to have an election. We went through these horrible NLRB hearings where, you know, they brought in people from the university who said, like, all sorts of crazy shit, like, oh, they're not real workers. And, like, there was, like, one person in our entire, like, 3,500-person unit that, like, worked at the fitness center as a yoga instructor. And they were like, they're all yoga instructors. Yoga instructors don't need a union. I'm like, what? Do you even know how grad... Also, yes, but also, do you know how, like, grad school works? All sorts of stuff. And then we finally won our election in September of last year. It was insane. Thank you. And there was, and then I went, and I adjuncted at Harvard for a bit, and we won an election in spring 2024, the very next, next year. So, like, been doing a lot of elections recently, is the point. And in each case, which also had, that one also had like 4 years of union busting to get to the election. But in each case, there was this fear of, you know, like we don't have a first contract yet, we don't have bylaws, like we don't know, like can we even form a Palestine caucus? Can we do this work? Can we pass a resolution? Is that allowed? Like just trying to figure out all of that stuff and just not being like super structured and also worried about like it's taken us this long to get here. What if we lose people supporting us over the issue of Palestine? And there was something that an organizer that I was working with said that was the people who are going to be the most radical on Palestine, on labor, on other intersectional issues, those are the people that are going to go on strike with you. Those are the people that are going to picket with you. Not the people who are sitting back and saying, I don't know, I'm a little uncomfortable, I'm not really sure about this. And you need to mobilize more of those people. And so we just, in both cases, I and you know many other of my comrades got together and we just pushed hard. And we said, it doesn't matter if we lose a couple of Zionists in our unit who, you know, revoke their authorization cards or say that they're not gonna vote for us or whatever. Like, bye. Bitch, bye. We don't care. We are still gonna win this, and we're gonna win this because we're going to be principled, and that's going to drive more people, particularly people of color who have often felt disenfranchised by the traditional labor movement, into this local and into the organizing work. Sure. And it worked. Mm-hmm. And it has worked. And I think we have more questions to talk about all the pushback, I think, about from like the international and whether we're satisfied and all of that that we can
get
into.
We're running low on time, so if you want to hit that real quick.
Do you want, can I hit it? Okay, yeah, awesome. Okay, so. Okay, so yeah, so there's definitely been backlash. There's been really, really a loud minority of Zionists who have attacked, they love to attack the Arab woman in the room. Sharina knows this, I know this. They love to go after us, they love to misinterpret everything that we say. And
try
me. Like, yeah, and it's just like,
I'm not scared.
You got nothing, like, I'm a social scientist, I study human rights in the Middle East, like, you really want to go head to head on whether or not this is a genocide? This is going to be real fun. And so there's been a lot of backlash. There's been, you know, international leadership backlash, definitely lots of people who run away from me too when they see me at conferences now. And, you know, also the very famous incident where I and two of my comrades, one of whom is in the same union as me at Northeastern, and another who's with the Columbia Graduate Student Workers, protested the speech in which Sean Fain announced that they were going to endorse Biden, and were, you know, very aggressively dragged out by Secret Service, and you had all of these people chanting, like, UAW, UAW, as we got dragged out. Like, it's not been pretty, and there have been threats. I also got in trouble for stuff that I taught, both at Harvard and at Northeastern, and I really just think, like, we're going to keep standing together in solidarity, we're going to keep pushing back, and we're going to win. That's the only way forward.
Yeah, just to pick up on exactly these points about, you know, the myth or the lie that somehow Palestine is an anathema to union organizing or labor activism, when in fact it's the exact opposite. And, you know, in my local, 2325, so my union, my local is an amalgamated local, meaning it represents people at different employers, but almost, but all of them are, some 3,000 members are public defenders, mainly in New York City. Both attorneys and other legal workers. And in 2022, so I should just also say that when I was president of my local from 1990 to 2002, I was finally ousted after being repeatedly reelected over the issue of opposing the so-called war on terror and especially supporting Palestine. So it was a year after 9/11 in New York City, and the Zionists kind of, you know, worked together with others who had their own, you know, grievances or axes to grind, and that happened. Fast forwarding to 20 years exactly after that, our local adopted a resolution demanding transparency and divestment from the international UAW around Israel bonds. And then in October 20th, so this is just like a couple weeks after October 7th, one of our units, the Bronx Defenders Union, at our local, issued a statement saying, quote, this is the essence of it, "We do not consent to Israel's genocidal rhetoric and actions against the Palestinian people, and we do not consent to U.S. political support for this genocide." That then led to a proposal to have the whole membership vote of the entire union, the 3,000 members, to vote on a resolution calling for ceasefire in Gaza, end to Israeli occupation of Palestine, support for workers' political speech. And that motion, or that proposal, went to the membership. The vote started, this is in late October or early November, 15 minutes before the vote was to conclude, a court in Nassau County, which is like, you know, sort of Hicksville in New York City, like outside of New York City, issued an order saying that the vote could not be completed because some four Zionist members of our union went to court and got this judge to issue this blatantly unconstitutional order. When that order was finally dissolved by a federal judge in Brooklyn a few weeks later, the motion passed by a membership vote of 1,067 to 570. So it was a 65% to 35% landslide, basically saying we are public defenders. You think we're going to back off because some Zionist members got some hick court to, you know, say we couldn't do it? You know, it's what we do every day as we stand.
You might live in Nassau County now.
Right. So the point, I think, is that, you know, and there's been a subsequent witch hunt now, which is in Congress, and they're trying to force us to, you know, that's the committee that's been investigating the universities, the same committee. Mm-hmm. So the point is, and there are still members of our union, the minority, who will say, well, you see, we shouldn't have done this because of all the backlash. But the reality is that this Palestine battle in our local has brought more activists, more young members into being activists in the union around all kinds of issues than had been the case for years. And just to give you an example, in May Day, we had May Day rally for Palestine oriented towards workers in New York City. And that rally had, you know, thousands of people, of whom I would say about 500 or 600 were UAW members in New York City who came out for this May Day for Palestine, most of them members, I think, of my local. And the last thing I'll say about the example of this is that then a couple of months ago, Bronx Defenders Union, which I mentioned earlier as being the first group to say something since October in our local, and took an incredibly strong, no holds barred, none of this kind of just, we're just for ceasefire, you know, but we condemn Hamas, none of that. Or use the energy that they had gotten by organizing around Palestine
of their young membership in the Bronx to win an amazing contract battle where they basically forced management, which had been set up, by the way, by Giuliani to break our strike in 1994, but now was being confronted by this militant, incredibly diverse, largely people of color-led union, to basically say, if you don't do this, we're going to strike. And they held one-day strikes, and they forced management to back down, and they got an amazing contract. Mm-hmm. So I just think it goes to the point that others here have made, that that it's a lie that somehow Palestine detracts from. No, Palestine frees us all, as the phrase goes. And this is an example of that.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.